The aerial photo that you can see has Harrison's Island on it. To the left or west is Virginia. To the right or east is Maryland. You got to remember that the Potomac flows due south at that point. So when you're standing in Virginia looking at Maryland, you're not looking to the north. You're looking to the east. You got to turn everything 90 degrees. The battlefield, of course, is just there to the left or to the east of Harrison's Island. The Union troops, for the most part, were camped in Maryland, in between Poolesville. Those of you who are familiar with the geography of Montgomery County will know Poolesville. And then there's Edwards Ferry, and the other direction is what is now White's Ferry, Conrad's Ferry at the time of the battle. And that whole area was basically one big Union camp. The battle, obviously, on the Virginia side. The other map is what we consider to be the definitive map of the battlefield on the day of the battle. This was drawn by Captain William Francis Bartlett, who commanded Company I of the 20th Massachusetts. Bartlett was on the battlefield before dawn. He did not leave until well after dark, and he was not under fire until mid-afternoon, so he had plenty of time to explore the battlefield, get a sense of what it looked like. He drew that map 3 days after the battle. It appeared in a letter to his mother when he was describing the situation to her. Because of that, because he had so much time, because he was there and drew it quickly, shortly after the battle, that is what we believe to be the definitive map. There are dozens of different maps of the Ball's Bluff battlefield that appear in newspapers, memoirs and things, and none of them look alike. It's the strangest thing. You have these weird shapes. Some are circles, some are oval, some are square. They have all kinds of different delineations for where the troops were. The paths are drawn in all sorts of ways. Some look like a spider web. Some look like there's just one somewhere. It's a strange thing, but they're weird collection of maps for Ball's Bluff. That's the one you want to pay attention to, the Bartlett map. Okay? Now, what I'm going to do is just kind of go through the story of Ball's Bluff, and I want you, if you have questions, to ask me right as you have them. Don't wait till the end. I'd rather you have asked the question while it's fresh in your mind and I can address it at that time. Before I do that, before I tell you what Ball's Bluff was, I want to tell you what Ball's Bluff was not. And this has to do with the first item on the myth list. Ball's Bluff was not an attack on Leesburg. Ball's Bluff had absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with an attack on Leesburg. The traditional telling of the Ball's Bluff story has been that it was a pre-planned but bungled attempt by the Federals to take Leesburg. It looked like that. People were expecting, particularly on the Confederate side, expecting something like that to happen, so that when what actually did happen began to occur, There was this kind of sense of, aha, here it comes. You can see this in the writings and what we know about Colonel Shanks Evans. And the assumption, because there were actually three separate groups of Union troops in the area, it looked like a planned envelopment of Leesburg. And much of the story was told that way. As I go through the story, you'll see that that was not the case at all. It just kind of looked that way. There were appearances, there were expectations. Everybody knew the Yanks were coming across the river sooner or later anyway. And to understand this, we have to go back to 1st Manassas on July 21st. Ball's Bluff is 3 months to the day later on October 21st. And in that three-month time, what you have is a lot of all quiet along the Potomac kind of things. Manassas happens. Confederates win, but they're just as beat up and disorganized as the Federals. Everybody falls back. The Federals fall back on the Potomac. It becomes a kind of defensive moat. Confederates hang out along Bull Run, which flows into the Occoquan, which flows into the Potomac. So you have these two long water lines of defense, what, 30 miles apart, with the main bodies of the armies looking at each other for much of the summer and early fall of 1861, pretty much leaving each other alone. The Confederates, however, are maintaining some outposts up near the Union lines. Most of those outposts are up closer to Washington, Munson's Hill, the whole area where they can overlook the thing. You know that. But there was an outpost at Leesburg, well to the west. Now, that outpost was there for a couple of reasons. One, because of the roads. You have a major and very strategically significant intersection, strategically significant in October of 1861, at Leesburg. And that's the center of town. You've all been to Leesburg, I'm sure, right where the courthouse is. Route 15 today runs north and south, the old Carolina Road. I am going to kill myself on this thing. Try it this way. runs north and south. Route 15 was the interstate in 1861. Major north-south thoroughfare. Route 7 crosses it. Today's Route 7. The Alexandria-Winchester Turnpike, communications out into the Shenandoah Valley, all the way from Alexandria. That is a significant intersection. And also, to the west of 15 in Loudoun County, you've got a couple of other good north-south roads that connect to the river, so you can cross the river on good roads in a number of places moving north or south. Now, whoever controls that intersection, and in particular, whoever controls the crossings, the fords, no bridges at this point because they'd all been burned, the fords and the ferry sites, is in a good position to flank the other side. If you can move northward on 15, you're the Confederate Army, you get across that river, you can swing around and come in on the federal flank and threaten Washington, Baltimore, Philadelphia, whatever. Evansville, Indiana, if you felt like it. If you're on the federal side and you want to come down, obviously you can get down and flank the Bull Run line. So it's a critical, very significant piece of ground. One of the things to remember about that is that the number of fords. There are something like 19 good fords in the stretch of the Potomac River that forms the boundary between Loudoun County and Montgomery County, Maryland. Good militarily usable fords, by which I mean not, of course, just that the water is shallow. That's the easy part. But the bottom of the river has to be firm for it to be militarily usable. You got to get wagons and artillery and everything across. It does you no good to have knee-deep water and you run your artillery out there and it sinks to the hubs in muck. Firm bottom. And the banks are not so steep that you can't get down to it. They have to be kind of cut back and laid back. Roads come down there. You've got to be able to get to it, cross it without sinking into it, and of course not have the water real deep. Militarily usable fords, and there were a bunch of them, and they were close together. So either side could use them, cross troops at several places at once. Those troops would be in supporting distance of each other when they got across, and you're good to go. Therefore, following First Manassas, the Confederates put their little outpost, their sort of tripwire force, Shanks Evans' 2,800-man brigade, out there to watch the crossings of the river. Yankees did the same thing. Shortly after Manassas, they sent what originally started as a small brigade, gradually grew and grew by the time of our battle. It was General Stone's 3-brigade division of some 12,000 men. Confederates had 2,800 men. Didn't matter, really, because nobody was planning to come across at this point. Eventually, yes, but at this time, not. The situation was quiet. A little bit of taking pot shots, the pickets shooting at each other every once in a while. There are some anecdotal stories about that that are kind of fun in a way. You hear about some Yankees complaining because they were armed with smoothbore muskets. This was part of the 2nd New York State Militia that had smoothbore muskets. And the Confederates opposite them had rifles. And so the Confederates could reach the other side of the river. The Federals couldn't effectively shoot back. So some of these guys from the 2nd New York got a hold of some guys from the 1st Minnesota who were also armed with rifles. And the 1st Minnesota guys came up there early before dawn, and when the Confederate pickets on the other side of the river showed themselves, they killed about three or four of them, before the Confederates knew what had hit them. So you have that sort of thing, but it didn't happen much. Most of the time, these pickets would have little localized truces. You know, hey, Yank! You don't shoot at me and I won't shoot at you. You know, okay, Reb, that works. And they leave each other alone. Do the usual fraternization, go meet out in the river and trade tobacco for sugar, newspapers, all that kind of stuff. It all happened right there early in the war and you read about it later. Same stuff. Heck, they'd occasionally have each other over for dinner. And one of the Confederates later on was writing about their time in Leesburg early in the war, and he described it as a very civil war. And that's the way they pretty much left each other alone. And then in October, early October, everything begins to change. Several things happen. You got, first of all, the fact that Nathan Evans is starting to get a little nervous about his situation out there. He's got 2,800 guys. The federal force is gradually growing. He realizes that. We get indications that Joe Johnson is starting to wanting to move men around. Evans is out there by himself. And then, on the first two or three days of October, the Federals get a huge reinforcement. At that point, by, say, 1st of October, they've got maybe 6,500, 7,000 men. By the 4th of October, they've got 12,000 men. Because they had added to their force this very large 4-regiment brigade, collectively known as the California Brigade, under the command of Colonel/Senator Edward Baker of Oregon. Now, Baker's California Brigade is an interesting story. I'm not going to tell it now, but if we've got time later and somebody wants to remind me, I'll go into it. It's a fascinating story of Baker himself and these four, quote, California regiments, which in fact were not California regiments at all. They were mostly Pennsylvanians, but I'll tell you about how that works out. Point is, if you're Shanks Evans, by the way, who knows why he's called Shanks? Several of you do. Why? He was knock-kneed, basically. Shanks was his West Point nickname. He was an 1848 graduate of West Point, and his West Point buddies nicknamed him Shanks because he had skinny legs with knock-kneed. Shanks Evans is out there, and he sees all of a sudden this force on the other side of the river almost doubles overnight. Well, that's going to get his attention, and he begins to worry about that. A few days later, on the 9th of October, General George McCall, commanding what we now know as the Pennsylvania Reserves, crosses Chain Bridge from Maryland. Gets on the Virginia side, works his way upriver on the Virginia side, and he establishes a camp on top of a very high hill in Langley. Same place where the CIA is now, for the same reason. It's what General Sam Elliott in the movie called The High Ground. And that's why it's there. So he has another 12,000 Yankees up there on the high ground in Langley. So now you're Shanks Evans, and what are you thinking? Well, you got 12,000 Yankees right across the river. You got 12,000 Yankees maybe 25 miles away. But that 25 miles, they're connected. They're already on the Virginia side of the river, and they're connected by a good road. The rest of the Confederate Army is way down here on Bull Run, and there's not really good roads connecting them. They're a little farther away. So that means there's a whole lot of Yankees that are closer to him than any part of his army. And he begins to worry about that. And then on the 15th, 16th of October, there's some minor skirmishing upriver from him at Harper's Ferry. John Geary's 28th Pennsylvania crosses over to go after some, I think it was a couple of wagon loads of corn or something that they figured they found was over there and they wanted the crops. So they go over, not a whole lot to it, but again, it gets Evans's attention. So on this day, this evening, the 16th of October, the morning of the 17th, Shanks Evans makes a fateful decision. He leaves on his own authority, does not get permission from his superiors to do this. He takes this strategically significant position with the road intersection and the fords, and he gives it up. He abandons it to the Union forces. He turns around, packs his entire brigade up around midnight, 16th and 17th, heads down what is basically Route 15, goes as far as Goose Creek where Oatlands is and sets up a defensive position on the other side there and waits. Well, on the 17th, as he's doing this, he sends a message to General Beauregard telling him what he's doing. And Beauregard is not happy about this. He writes him a letter, a note back, which is in very nice 19th century polite language, but the tone of it is something along the lines of, "Are you out of your freaking mind? Who told you to leave this position right now? I didn't. You know, would you like to please tell me what exactly you're doing?" Very sarcastic letter. Evans took the hint. And within a couple days, he's back. Now, but he's gone for 2 days, almost 3 days. The Federals realize this. Word gets back to General McClellan. "Sir, the Rebs aren't there anymore." McClellan thinks about this. You may have heard McClellan
days
was a...
Days and days and
days. Well, as I say, you may have heard he was a fairly cautious fellow, and he's giving this some consideration, and you think, okay, this has got to be a trap. For all the fun we make of McClellan's extra, you know, over-cautiousness and all that, he was right in this instance. He was right. There was no militarily good reason for the Confederates to have abandoned Leesburg at this point. It made no sense. So he was cautious, and he thought, well, maybe it's a trap. Rather than just advance all of his guys and walk into this possible trap, rather than send General Stone across the river, even though Stone was closer, a riverine crossing at any time is a difficult thing to do, especially if you think you might be going into a trap on the other end. And remember, this is 1861. This is early in the war. These guys are civilians in uniform. You don't want to ask them to do something like that. These are not Marines. They do not know how to assault across water. And on the other side of the river, at Ball's Bluff anyway, you know, that's not Normandy, and you don't have the Rangers to scale that bluff. You've got these guys, these 1861 soldiers. So what McClellan does is tell Stone to stay where he is. Basically, doesn't tell Stone anything. He just ignores him for the day. But he tells General McCall, take your guys from Langley, go to Drainsville, and from Drainsville, I want you to probe toward Leesburg and see, are these guys gone or not? Well, there's not a real lot of good march discipline and such in the Union Army at this point, so it takes them to get from Langley to Drainesville takes about 2 days after they get the word to do this. So by the time the Federals are in Drainesville probing toward Leesburg, the Confederates are back. It's very confusing. McClellan goes to Drainesville on the night of the 19th, and he meets with McCaw. What's going on, McCaw? He said, well, they were gone. We know they were gone, but then now they're here again, and so we're not quite sure what to do. McClellan doesn't like the smell of it. He says, forget it. Tomorrow morning, which would be Sunday, October 20th, I want you to go back to your camp there by the CIA. And McCall says, yes, sir, I can do that. But, show your badge, and then they'll let you in. Says, I can do that, but one of the things I've been doing today, aside from probing and seeing if the Rebs are there, is making some maps. We don't have any real good maps of this particular piece of ground, and I'd like to finish my maps. Can I have another day? Okay, you can do that. But the next morning, which would be Monday, October 21st, I want you to leave. Go back to your camp at Langley. So he is ordered out of the area on the night of the 19th. He's not actually going to leave until the morning of the 21st, and it's the morning of the 21st when all the fighting is ginning up at Ball's Bluff. A lot of the accounts that you hear throughout the secondary sources that tell the story put McCall as one big column of a three-pronged envelopment of Leesburg. But he clearly wasn't. He was ordered away 36 hours before there was any fighting. On the morning of the 21st, as the fighting gins up, his 12,000 Union troops are headed the other way. On the 20th, McClellan gets in touch with General Stone across the river, Charles Pomeroy Stone, a man I've come to admire very much. I am trying to write a biography of him. But he is an amazing man. He got treated horribly. And he bounced back in several incarnations later on, which again, if there's time later, I'll talk a little bit about him. I have an enormous respect for this man. I will tell you this. He's a footnote today, but he was highly respected by his professional peers. Ulysses Grant, shortly after he left the presidency, did an interview in which he was talking about his own experiences in the early days of the war when he was an obscure colonel. And he was asked who he thought at the time might be the people who would lead the army. And he rattled off a couple of names. One of them was Charles Stone. He believed, he overlapped with him for a couple of years in West Point, and he fully believed at that time that Charles Stone was probably going to lead the Union Army. Had it not been for the aftermath of Ball's Bluff, he might have. But let's get back to the story. Stone is told by McClellan on the 20th, says, McCall is in Drainesville. Watch for him. Which means don't shoot at his men if you see them on the other side of the river. And perhaps, and this is a little key phrase that you see, McClellan tells Stone, perhaps a slight demonstration on your part would have the effect to help move them. By that he means, look, McCall's moving around in the area anyway. He's kind of fooling around. He's got troops there. The Rebs are going to be looking at him. Why don't you make some noise too? And maybe between the two of you, it'll do something. And if the Confederates are thinking about leaving, they'll sort of get spooked and they'll leave and we'll get Leesburg as a freebie. Stone says, yes, sir, I can do that. And he proceeds to conduct his slight demonstration, which involves moving some boats down into the water, putting some men in them, getting ready to cross over. He has his artillery shell a few areas on the Virginia side around Edwards Ferry, three or four spots on the river. He has troops positioned on the river at several spots. Basically, he's making it look like he's coming across. He's conducting a feint. Shanks Evans is a trained soldier. He's a West Pointer. He recognizes a feint when he sees one, so he ignores it. Nothing happens. Gets to be dusk. End of the slight demonstration. Stone brings all of his men back to their camps. McCall's in camp anyway, getting ready to turn around and go the other way. And that really could have been the end of the story. Nothing had to happen after that. But historians have often confused this slight demonstration with the battle. And you will frequently see, including in the Washington Post about a week ago, a story by a gentleman who says Ball's Bluff was a slight demonstration by the Federals on Leesburg. It was not. The demonstration was over. What did happen was that General Stone decided to see if this slight demonstration had had any effect. So he orders a reconnaissance patrol. Harrison's Island, which you can see on your map there, is one of the many large islands in the Potomac. They're all farms. So either the Confederates or the Federals would occupy these things periodically to get the food. The Federals happened to be on Harrison's Island, 15th Massachusetts. So the 15th Massachusetts under Colonel Charles Devens. Now that's the Fort Devens, Massachusetts, Chancellorsville Devens. That's not the Devon cavalry guy at Gettysburg, okay? Different. Charles Devens is told by General Stone to put together a recon patrol, cross over there at Ball's Bluff, go on out, do what recon patrols do, and tell me what you see. And that's all it is. It's just a reconnaissance patrol. You get 15 to 20 guys, depending on who you read. They cross over at dusk, and they're going to walk out up the path. They do not scale the bluff. You read all sorts of Union accounts about how we scaled the bluff. They did not scale the bluff. They walked up the path. It's a steep path, I grant you, and it was a muddy path because it had been raining for the month of October in 1861, but it's still a path. They walked up it. They go out. Now, this is something that's always kind of interested me because here you've got a bunch of guys who've never been in engine country before. They've never been under fire. They're going over into enemy territory in the dark. They're walking through the woods. You've all camped. You've been in the woods. You know it. Every little sound is magnified. These guys are kind of creeping down the path. They're walking along, hearing everything. You can imagine what was going through their minds and how fast their hearts were beating as they're doing this. But they get out there. They cross over. They get out past through where Ball's Bluff is now, up past the cemetery, out into where the subdivision is now, and they see what they think is a Confederate camp. Now, they go back and report this. Again, it's early war. It's 1861. These are very inexperienced guys, and you see this in the Ball's Bluff story, the Manassas story too, about this early war inexperience. They simply look off in the distance. They think they see the tops of tents. They say, that must be a Confederate camp, and back they go, and they report that. So General Stone gets, in the middle of the night on October 20th, a faulty intelligence report of this Confederate camp. They saw no campfires. They saw nobody moving around, no troops. So what do you hear in a camp? I mean, you'd hear horses moving around and snorting. You'd hear somebody playing a fiddle. There'd be some activity. And there was nothing. So the report that Stone got was along the lines of that either this camp was abandoned or it was unguarded. General Stone takes this faulty intelligence report and says, all right, if it's unguarded, then they're being really careless. And you cannot let an enemy get away with that kind of carelessness. We're going to hit them. If it's abandoned, then maybe all this movement that's been going around for the past couple of days has had some effect. And if their tents are still there, that means they left in a hurry. So maybe something's going on here. This could be important. We got to check it out. So he then gets back to Devens and says, take half your regiment. All this is happening in the middle of the night. Take half your regiment. Works out to about 300 men. Cross the river from the island to Virginia, across the relatively narrow Virginia channel of the river. However, remember, as I said, it had been raining every day in October. The river was up, and you know what the Potomac's like when it's up. I personally would not want to be in a small skiff in the Potomac in that narrow channel where the current is probably rushing like a toilet flushing with all kind of logs and Lord knows what else in the dark, you know. But they do it. He has to cross 300 men in three small skiffs, and he does it without losing a man. Takes them several hours, but they do it. Little shuttle service. They go across, they send a boat back, they go get a few more, go across back and forth all night. So he gets up there, he gets his men ready to go. It's dawn on October 21st. They're up there about where the cemetery is now. They're deployed. They're ready to go. It gets to be light, and away they go down the path. 300 men, they're going to raid this camp. And their orders specifically say, return to your present position. So this is not any kind of big column that's going to attack Leesburg. It's a 300-man raiding party. But in some of the accounts, that's the second of the three prongs. You've got McCall's big force. You've got this force under Devens. That's the second of the three-pronged assault on Leesburg. It's a raiding party. He goes out there. They get out, and they discover that the guys in the reconnaissance patrol had not seen tents at all. They saw a row of trees. Not, as some people say, haystacks. They saw a row of trees. You've got the trunks of trees, the spaces between them, the branches hanging down like this, and they're in a row, so you get this jagged appearance in the moonlight and everything that looks like the tops of trees, and so that's what they reported. They get out there, and it's this, oops, what do we do now? You know, very embarrassing kind of a thing, but they don't turn around and come back. Colonel Devens could very well have said, well, raiding party's got nothing to raid. Let's go get some breakfast, guys, you know, and head on back. But he uses his discretionary authority. He's the commander on the ground, and he says, well, let's see what's going on here. Nobody knows we're here. Let's wait. He deploys his men in a tree line. The tree line, and you're all familiar with it, right where the subdivision ends, you got a cul-de-sac, and then the park road begins. That tree line is more or less the same as it was in 1861. That's where those guys were. If you're facing the park, if you're in the cul-de-sac facing the park, it would be the area off to your left and slightly behind. It goes around. It's north of the subdivision. The Jackson house is still out there. It was there at the time of the battle, owned by a woman named Margaret Jackson, a widow with seven children. The house has been much refurbished, of course, but it is still there. And they wait. And Devon sends a messenger back, Lieutenant Church Howe, 23-year-old accountant from Boston, one of the really cool, really, really cool-looking guy. He's got a set of side whiskers on him that Ambrose Burnside would die for. Yeah. They are magnificent. And he's got this real cocky, he's a young guy, and he's got his photo of him. It's in the book, and he's got his head kind of off to the side, his hat, and his kepi is cocked. He's the kind of guy that would be a fighter pilot if he were in the service today. He's got this attitude about him. I love this guy. He was in the 6th Massachusetts that came through Baltimore and got fired on in April.
Stations, yeah.
Yeah, train. He was a private in the 6th when they came through Baltimore. So he was in that. Then he got his commission because he was an accountant, and so they made him the quartermaster of the 15th Massachusetts. So he is the messenger. He's got to go back from where they are out in the fields, out around the Jackson house, which is maybe 3/4 of a mile from the bluff. He does that on foot. He goes down the bluff. He crosses the Virginia Channel of the river in a boat. He crosses Harrison's Island, 300-400 yards wide, on foot. He crosses the much wider Maryland Channel in another boat. He gets up onto, across the C&O Canal. He gets on a towpath on a horse, and he rides 3 miles down to Edwards Ferry where General Stone is. He finds General Stone. He reports to General Stone, "Sir, the raiding party has nothing to raid. Colonel Devens would like further instructions. What should we do?" General Stone ponders this a minute. He says, "Well, all right, raiding party can't be a raiding party. We'll turn it into an expanded reconnaissance. It all looks kind of quiet. You go back, Lieutenant, and tell Colonel Devens that I'm going to send him the rest of his regiment, another 350 guys or so. And when they get there, I want Colonel Devens to advance a little bit, and we'll just have an expanded recon. This is not an attack on Leesburg again. He'll have 650 guys unsupported, so you just go and see what you can see." Yes, ma'am?
Is the 15th Massachusetts the Harvard Regiment?
No, that's the 20th Massachusetts. 15th was from areas of Boston. You had a couple of companies from Worcester, and so there, that whole area around Boston. For some reason, the 15th had a lot of guys who were shoemakers. The shoe industry wasn't doing real well at the time. There were a lot of unemployed shoemakers, and a bunch of them joined the 15th Massachusetts. So they probably did okay on footwear, like most, a lot of other units didn't. But anyway, he gets there, and he's reporting to Stone, who gives him these new instructions. Back he goes. While he's doing that, making that long trek and then back, The Devens and his guys out there bump into some pickets from the 17th Mississippi, and they have the first firefight. So Stone's getting more bad information because the messenger is saying, "Sir, nothing's happening, but something's happening. They're shooting at each other already, and nobody knows it." So these reinforcements are going on their way, thinking they're going to go on a reconnaissance mission. Now the messenger goes back. Howe goes back to Devens and he reports this. About the time he's halfway through his report, Devens says, yeah, that's all fine, but everything's different now because we've made contact with the enemy. Go back to Edwards Ferry again, find General Stone, and tell him that we have in fact made contact with the enemy. So we need more new instructions. What are you going to do? You're going to support us? You want me to pull back? Whatever. All right? So this, by now, exhausted 23-year-old lieutenant, I'm sure, just saluted and said, "Yes, sir," but you can imagine what he was thinking. Jesus, can't somebody else do this? You know, I mean, really, you know. But back he goes. In the meantime, while he's doing all of this, who should show up at the camp of General Stone but Colonel/Senator Baker? Baker's California Brigade has had nothing to do with any of this. They're actually upriver, closer to the Monocacy. But he shows up in Stone's camp and he says, "Look, I know you got all this stuff going on. We haven't been part of it. Can I help? Anything my men can do, anything I can do?" And Stone tells him what he knows, which is basically wrong. So, well, we had this this sighting of a camp, but it turned out not to be a camp, so we're going to turn it into a larger reconnaissance. And I tell you what, Baker, as long as you're here, why don't you go on back up to Ball's Bluff where all this, where they crossed. Now, we're in Maryland now. So he's not even on the island. They've got to get across to the island and then across to Ball's Bluff. You go on up this side of the river, check out the situation, and then if you want to pull back the troops who were there, that's fine. If you want to send more troops over, that's fine. Both of these men are thinking reconnaissance. They do not know there has been fighting. General Stone has gotten a lot of criticism over the years for giving the inexperienced politician Colonel Baker this combat command. But he did not give him a combat command. He gave him a reconnaissance mission command. Baker works his way upriver. He's on his way to Ball's Bluff. That happens to be where everybody was crossing. And he runs into the messenger coming back the second time, who tells him there has been fighting. Baker says, "I will cross with all of my men." And that's the message that the messenger then takes to General Stone. Stone says, "Okay, I put him in command. I'm going to let him take care of that section of the field. I'm going to see, watch here." Stone does not know, as this story develops during the course of the day, Stone does not know that McCall is gone. McClellan never told Stone that he had recalled General McCall. So all during the day, Stone is at Edwards Ferry. One of the reasons he's not going down to Ball's Bluff is because he's positioning himself to be in the middle. He thinks there's 12,000 Union troops that might come in from his left on the Virginia side from Drainsville, and he would have to coordinate with that. Baker's fine out there on the right, and Stone's going to be in the middle. It's the place he ought to be, but he's gotten heavily criticized for all of this. Doesn't know McCall's not there. All right. Baker goes over, having told the messenger he's going to cross with all his men, and proceeds not to cross with all his men. He orders all the Union troops he can find to cross. And in that part of the field, it was not just Baker's troops. There were other Union troops there, maybe some almost 7,000 Union troops in that part of the field, the federal right. Baker gets command of all of them and starts grabbing them and saying, "Get across the river, get across the river." But nobody had planned to cross the river. So they don't have a lot of boats. Or as General Stone put it in a situation report to General McClellan later in the day, "We're a little short of boats." And they were. Baker, realizing they're short of boats, but also realizing that they've got to get men across the river, stays on the Maryland side for almost 4 hours. Instead of going across the river himself and assigning that job to his quartermaster or to a competent senior non-com, somebody, "Find me some boats," he fools around himself trying to find boats. And they find a few skiffs and a couple of, they schlep a C&O canal boat up out of the canal over the area to the river and get it down into the water. They pick the thing up. And then they've got a couple of these flat barge-like things that Stone had had made for hauling supplies up and down. So they gradually get boats in the river, sort of. And then they've got to have this shuttle service to get guys from Maryland to the island, then another shuttle service to get guys from the island to the Virginia side. So it's a bottleneck. Right from the get-go, it's a bottleneck. You've got roughly 7,000 men on that side of the field. 1,700 of them get to Ball's Bluff. The rest of them stand in line all day. And the bands play, and they make campfires and coffee and stuff, so they're entertaining themselves, but they're not where they ought to be. That's how this thing gets started. Now, I'm not going to go through a lot of details of the tactical stuff. You had the first skirmish that occurs between part of the 17th Mississippi, Company K, the Magnolia Guard, and part of the 15th Massachusetts. Excuse me. Then you've got a second skirmish a couple of hours later, a third skirmish later on around 1:30, 1 in the afternoon. The 8th Virginia shows up. The 8th Virginia is, of course, the home team, literally, because that's a Loudoun County unit. They fight a third skirmish, all with the 15th Massachusetts. All this time, all throughout the course of the morning, the hours are going by. There are other Union troops who are crossing in dribs and drabs as they finally get across the river, but they're not doing anything but deploying right there along the bluff where the cemetery now is, and waiting. The officer who's nominally in command, who's the senior, is Colonel William R. Lee of the 20th Massachusetts. Now, there are three skirmishes that take place 700-800 yards away. He can hear them, and he does not go out there. He simply keeps all those troops lined up. "Why did you do that?" he was asked later. "Well, I didn't have any orders to go out." You're a bird colonel. You're a colonel. You're allowed to think. You're allowed to make some decisions for yourself. It's okay for you to do that, you know. But he didn't. He didn't have any orders, and so he simply stayed where he was. He did not march to the sound of the guns. Colonel Devens finally decides he's tired of being hung out there to dry by himself and doing all the fighting. He knows that Baker has been placed in command, but he has not seen Baker. He has not heard from Baker. There are no orders. Baker has put no one in overall command on the Virginia side. Just so happens that Lee is kind of senior, so he more or less takes over and doesn't do anything. Baker finally shows up about 2 o'clock, 2:15. By coincidence, that's the same time that, having fought three skirmishes already, Colonel Devens says, enough of this. I'm going back to at least where I know there are my own people, other Union troops. So he falls back to the bluff. He is not driven back. The Confederate accounts are such puffery that it's just wonderful to read them. And so are some of the Union accounts, too, for what they do, like when they talk about scaling the bluff. The Confederates did not drive the 15th Massachusetts. There are eyewitness accounts of the 15th Massachusetts marching back in a nice, neat column of fours. You do not do that if you are being driven and shot at. Right? They marched back to the field, and if you look at the Bartlett map, you'll see where the road comes in. You imagine a line of Union troops with their backs to the bluff facing out. Devens comes in down that road, and then he advances sort of catty-cornered to his left across the field, and he lines up at right angles to and on the right of the existing federal line. So that what you get, if you're looking at it from the bluff, you have a line of Union troops with their backs to the bluff. 15th Mass guys come over, and they line up like this. So you have a kind of backwards L with that road that comes right down in between the backwards L. So any troops who come down into the battlefield on that road, and again, this is 1861. 1864, troops would have been a little more creative. Any troops who come down into that are going to walk slap into this crossfire. Okay? Now, you'd have to be stupid, of course, to lead troops deliberately into a crossfire like that. Colonel Erasmus Burt of the 18th Mississippi is not stupid. But he does lead his men later in the afternoon into that crossfire, come slap into it, because he cannot see the 15th Massachusetts guys on the right. They are in the woods, out of the clearing. The ground drops off there. They are undercover. He advances the 18th Mississippi toward the Union troops he can see, and they walk right into this devastating crossfire. Lige White is there. He reports later. You all know who Lige White is. He writes later, and he's gone through the whole war. He's seen pretty much everything. He refers to this volley that hits the 18th Mississippi and takes out 45 to 50 men. He calls it the single most devastating volley I saw in the war. The 18th Mississippi suffered 85 casualties on the day, over half of them in that single volley. They then fall back up to roughly where the parking lot now is, and they split into two battalions. Burt is killed. Well, he's mortally wounded. He's taken off, and he dies a few days later in Leesburg. Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Griffin takes command and decides he's not going to do that again. So he splits them into two, and he sends a battalion around to the Confederate left, a battalion around to the Confederate right to get into the woods, into the ravines, work your way down the ravines, get up on their flanks, and attack them from the flanks. On the right, the Confederate right, that's where you actually get most of the fighting of Ball's Bluff. And it's between the 18th Mississippi and this assortment of Union troops consisting of the 15th and 20th Mass, part of the 42nd New York, and part of the 1st California. But remember, the Union troops are coming over in dribs and drabs, so you don't really have these whole units. They're a little company here and a company there, and they get over. On the Confederate left, the Mississippi boys try to do the same thing, but the ground is, the Federals see this. I mean, they can see. All this is open now. They can see what the Confederates are doing. They send two companies from the 20th Mass, A and I, and one company from the... And one from the 15th to out... Sorry, two from the 15th and one from the 20th, A and I of the 15th, H of the 20th, to the Federal right, and they continue to sort of push the Confederates, who keep trying to get around them, so they keep going farther and farther away, and you end up with kind of a separate battle several hundred yards away that doesn't really have much effect on the main fighting, which is on the Federal left, with the Confederates coming up out sort of little round top style charging up this slope several times during the course of the day and being driven back and back and forth and back and forth. Everybody's running out of ammunition. We have accounts of the guys crawling forward and pulling ammo out of the cartridge boxes of the fallen enemy. Obviously, their weapons were compatible. All day long, this goes on. This continues until, well, now Baker has finally shown up, and Baker's in command. Now, Baker was not an idiot. Shelby Foote once called him a damn fool, but Shelby Foote was wrong. Shelby Foote was wrong about a lot of things, actually, but he was certainly wrong about Baker. Baker was not a damned fool. He was a very competent man. He just was not a soldier. He had served creditably, briefly, in the Mexican War, but he was not a soldier. He was not a trained tactician. He got into a situation that he thought was going to be a reconnaissance patrol. He discovers that it's a battle, and he did not handle it well. But he was not an idiot, and you should not think of him as one. In any case, he paid for his mistakes with his life. Baker's killed around 4:30, the only U.S. senator ever to die in battle. He was not killed where the marker says he was killed. We don't know exactly where he was killed, but we can pretty much demonstrate from the more credible accounts of his death that it couldn't have been there. It was probably inland, up closer to where the ground sort of drops off, maybe 100 yards inland. So, but main thing is he's dead. When this October 23rd Baker event, therefore, will be held at the famous marker that marks the spot where Baker wasn't killed. It'll be a good event anyway, okay? And you should go. I'm going to be speaking, so I can tell you this will be a good event, all right? Now, he's dead. Fortunately for the Federals, his death happens to coincide with a slight lull in the fighting because the Federals now have to figure out what they're going to do. There is this brief firefight over, this brief brawl, really, over Baker's body. He goes down. There's some Confederates who advance to probably just souvenir hunting. You know, they want his sword or whatever. But some of his guys rush forward, and you got about 20 guys on each side who are doing this battling thing over Baker's body, and the Federals save his body, and they take it and they put it back. I think the reason that stone is where it is because that's probably where they put his body when they brought it back off the field. It's kind of on the reverse side of a slight slope. It's near the path. Anybody coming up the path would have seen Baker laying there, and you can just see later, you know, guys, yeah, I remember that spot. I'm visiting the battlefield now 40 years later. Oh, yeah, that's where Colonel Baker was killed. So there was a little marker, a little stick was stuck up in the ground with a sign on it that said Baker was killed here. I think that's probably what happened. In any case, he's dead. You have these three colonels, William R. Lee of the 20th, Colonel Devens of the 15th Mass, and Colonel Milton Cogswell of the 42nd New York. Now you have the 1st California, who's commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Wister of Philadelphia. He's a mere lieutenant colonel, though, so he doesn't count. You've got three full colonels. They get together. They talk about things, who's senior. And it turns out they decide that it really doesn't matter because the guy who needs to be in command is the West Pointer, Milton Cogswell. That was the best decision the Federals made all day. Didn't do them any good in the end, but it was a good decision. Cogswell was a fine soldier. He had graduated class of 1849, year after Shanks Evans, so they knew each other. Interesting little tale about Cogswell. Shortly after he graduated, he was brought back to teach infantry tactics at West Point. And he did in the early 1850s. The superintendent at West Point in the early 1850s was a lieutenant colonel named Robert E. Lee. Some of you may have heard of him. He had daughters. His daughter Agnes kept a diary. And in her diary, Agnes speaks of her older sister Mary keeping a photograph of her Lieutenant Cogswell. Now, this was not something that Cogswell just, you know, click email. This was a photograph, which was a big deal in the 1850s. And for this young lady to have kept a photograph of this young gentleman implies that there was some relationship there, shall we say. So, in any case, nothing came of it, I suppose, because he went on his way and she went on hers and she never married. The image of Robert E. Lee with a son-in-law in the Union Army, I just love it. It's just delicious. The irony is just beautiful. You know? But it didn't happen, so there it is. Her Lieutenant Cogswell goes his way. He is now Colonel Cogswell, trying to figure out what to do with this situation at Ball's Bluff. Earlier in the day, when the 18th Mississippi had gotten shot up and fallen back and then split into two, the guy who had recognized that there was an opportunity here for the Federals was Colonel Milton Cogswell. And he told Baker, the fight will be on our left. We need to move everybody here. We need to go there. He would have, had Baker taken his advice, moved the entire Federal force through the gap in the Confederate line, because when they split, they left about a 200 to 300 yard hole in the middle of the line, right up where the parking lot is. Think Chickamauga. The same thing would have happened in miniature at Ball's Bluff. But Baker said, no, we shall meet them here. And he went on the defensive. Not a coward, not an idiot. He just made a bad decision. Baker's now dead. Cogswell's in command. And he says to the other two colonels, we're going to try this now. Both of them say, no, the battle's lost. We need to retreat. Cogswell says, maybe you're right, but if we try to retreat now with all these wounded men, this is going to turn into a rout. It's a desperation move, I know, but we're going to try it anyway. He recalls all of the Union troops that were over on the right, pulls them back, organizes his men into what he hopes will be a column with enough punch behind it to slam out up the slope, into the parking lot, and out into the subdivision. At which point he could turn left, march down to Edwards Ferry and link up with other Union troops that he knew were down there and be covered by Federal artillery from across the river the whole way. It was a very good idea. If he had tried it earlier in the day, it would have worked. We would be talking about a whole different Battle of Ball's Bluff. But it's late in the day. These guys are tired. This is their first battle. The Federals have never been in action before. Some of the Confederates had been at Manassas. They're running out of water. They're low on ammo. A lot of wounded. And it doesn't work. The thing basically falls apart before it ever happens. You get some Federals who see when they pulled them over from the right, of course, the Confederates who were there followed. Some of them charged back that way. Some of them went the way Cogswell wanted to go. It was a Chinese fire drill, basically, and the whole thing just kind of fell apart, and it didn't work. End of the story, Cogswell says, okay, it's over. We need to just save the wounded. So he lines up everybody with a gun and some ammo and says, hold them off as long as you can, boys. We're going to try to save the wounded. It works briefly. Until the 17th Mississippi shows up at the parking lot, deploys at the top of that slope with the 18th Mississippi, one battalion on their right, another on their left. The 8th Virginia, I should mention at this point, has been out of the fight for a while, came back briefly, made a final assault which on the far left, which took the couple of the mountain howitzers, the two mountain howitzers that were there, and then they withdrew again, leaving the mountain howitzers on the field. The 8th was there in the morning, did most of the fighting. But then they got messed up pretty badly, too, and left for a while. They were gone for like 90 minutes, 2 hours, until they came back. So the final climactic charge, and all my friends who are descendants of 8th Virginia people just hate it, but it's true. The final climactic charge at Ball's Bluff did not involve the 8th Virginia. It was an all-Mississippi affair with the 17th in the middle and those two battalions on their wings, and they advanced across the field, finally breaking the Federal line at the end of the day. Very much a battle like Manassas in the sense that it was a slugfest all day long. It could have gone either way, back and forth and back and forth, two guys just punching each other to death. At the very end of the day, in both fights, everything went wrong at one time for the Yanks, and it ended up being a rout. Ball's Bluff, though, they didn't have any place to run. They got down the cliff. They did not jump off a 100-foot cliff. The accounts of Ball's Bluff that talk about how the Confederates drove the Yankees over the cliff and gives you this image of men doing swan dives off a 100-foot cliff into the river. That did not happen. Remember I said Cogswell had called all the Union troops from the right. They were down on the southern end of Ball's Bluff. The rout took place behind the cemetery. It is not 110 feet high, and it is not sheer. It's very steep, and it's maybe 30 to 40 feet high, and they're running down this steep slope, tripping over deadfall and rocks and each other, and there's an account of one guy falling on the bayonet of the man in front of him, guy getting his foot caught between rocks and falling over and breaking his leg badly, and then they get down to the bottom, and there's a river. No boats. People in the 19th century did not swim for recreation like we do. They just didn't. Now, you had Company I of the 20th Massachusetts. Those guys were from Nantucket, so they probably could swim. Other than that, these guys basically got there and didn't know what to do. So they stripped off their heavy wool uniforms. They threw their weapons out into the river. And they took to the river. Found a branch or something that could float or had a buddy who could swim. A lot of them made it across to Harrison's Island. But remember, the river's up. The current is... They're swimming in that too. A lot of them just drowned. After a few minutes, you've got Confederates lining up on the bluff behind you. Bang, 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 shooting down. One guy described it. He kept saying it sounded like the bullets hitting the water all sounded, and he wrote it out, P-L-O-O-G. And it was a ploop, 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 ploop. It's a very descriptive kind of a sound. He said it was like being in a hailstorm. So many bullets coming down. Some of them made it. A lot of them didn't. Sir?
What time of day?
Dusk. It's about 6-ish, 6:20, something like that. Okay. The charge, the final climactic advance was just before dusk. So all this is happening just as it's getting dark. Okay. They get down there. Yeah, there was no standard time, so it's you get different accounts of the time. Yeah.
So the high bluff on the Virginia side would be casting a shadow down on the water and the island, sort of.
There was a moon. We know there had been a full moon the night before. So once it did get dark, and you had a number of guys who decided to try to swim the river in the dark, there was moon on the river, so the Confederates could see for a long time because of the moonlight. They finally did get to the point where they couldn't see what was happening. But you did have all these guys who took to the river. You had quite a few of them, several hundred, who said, I can't swim. I'm not going to go in a river and either drown or get shot. They worked their way back up the floodplain to the point where the bluff was very steep, very sheer, rather, and they hunkered down against the base of it where they'd be out of the line of fire. Later that night, several hours later, a bunch of them ended up surrendering anyway. Now, there's all kinds of more stories and anecdotes and things I can go on. Let me briefly tell you about the first California and why they're called the California, and then I'll take some questions. All right? Is that okay? Edward Baker, best friend of Abraham Lincoln, grew up in Philadelphia, moved west to Springfield, Illinois as a young man, became a lawyer, became acquainted with this other young lawyer in Springfield. They became good friends. Lincoln's had a son named Edward Baker Lincoln. The wives were good friends. They were both Whigs, so they were on the same side politically. They kind of shared the House seat in Congress from that district. Baker took it once, and Lincoln took it once. Baker, in 1850, decided to do what a lot of people did in 1850. California had become a state. He's going to go west. He gets there, actually, in 52, and becomes a power. He's a well-known man. Now, Edward Baker is virtually unknown today, unless you're from Oregon, where there's Mount Baker and Baker County and a couple things like that. But everybody in America knew who Ned Baker was in 1861. He was a very prominent public figure. He goes to California, tries to organize the Whigs. He wants a Senate seat from California, never gets it. Of course, the Whig Party implodes in the mid-50s. He and Lincoln and a lot of other Whigs sort of gravitate into this new Republican Party. He becomes instrumental in organizing that. Baker has been called the father of the Republican Party in California. He and Lincoln, of course, both become Republicans, and so they're still on the same side politically. He still wants a Senate seat, but he doesn't get it. 1859, Oregon becomes a state. The new Republican Party in Oregon says, come on up here and help us get organized, and if it works, we'll get control of the legislature and we'll make you a senator. Baker says, close enough. No, I wanted to do it from California. I'll do it from Oregon. I like to figure that's kind of where Hillary got the idea to move to New York. She knew about Baker. He did it first.
Okay. And there's no reason.
Robert Kennedy did the same thing, too. He moved to New York. He knew, I'm going to go someplace where I know I can be a senator. Baker did it. And it worked. He got there, so now he's a senator. It's 1860. He's back in Washington. The war comes. 2 weeks after Fort Sumter, Baker and a bunch of other guys who have West Coast connections realize the importance of keeping the West Coast tied to the Union, these two new states. There was a secession movement in California. There was, believe it or not, a secession movement in Oregon. There is no guarantee that those two states were going to stick to the Union. One way to help that would be to have California troops and Oregon troops, but it was all focused on California, have California units in the Union Army under the California name, symbolically tying the state to the Union. So Baker and a bunch of other guys go to New York. They hold a big rally on the 21st of April at Union Square in New York. Big, wonderful broadsides posted up and join Colonel Baker's California Regiment. Great big black letters, magnificent things. To join Colonel Baker, he was Colonel Baker because he'd been a colonel in Mexico, so he really could be called a colonel. Baker was, as I say, very well known. So there was a certain panache to to being in Colonel Baker's California regiment. That's cool. So they thought they would get a good reception, and they did. They got several hundred guys to sign up, but Baker had to go back to Washington to do his senator thing. So he gets in touch with Isaac Wister, an old law partner from California who's now living in Philadelphia. Been to Philadelphia, there's a Wister Institute. It's a medical institute named after, Wister founded it later, but it's named after his uncle who was a doctor. Isaac Wister is in Philadelphia. Baker says, Wister, come to New York and finish doing all this organizing for me. I'm going to be the colonel, but you can be the lieutenant colonel. Wister says, okay, I'll be a lieutenant colonel, but I don't know anybody in New York. Can I do this recruiting thing in Philadelphia? Close enough. All right. So it all happens in Philadelphia. He wants to get a regiment to be known as the California Regiment. They get enough men for four regiments. A huge outpouring of support to be in Colonel Baker's command. These four regiments become known as the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 5th California. It's a California thing, The 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 5th California become collectively known as the California Brigade, and they are at Ball's Bluff. About half of the 1st California actually fights at Ball's Bluff. Baker's dead. Baker's the guy who got them called California Regiment. Governor Andrew Curtin of Pennsylvania didn't get to count those guys in Pennsylvania's quota, and he was not real happy about them being called California troops. So he did his governor thing, and he got their names changed. And the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 5th California became the 71st, 69th, 72nd, and 106th Pennsylvania. 69? Yes. And the California Brigade becomes the Philadelphia Brigade, which goes to glory in the West Woods at Antietam and the Copse of Trees at Gettysburg and a couple of other places. Go to the Copse of Trees and look on the 71st Pennsylvania Monument. On one side it says 71st Pennsylvania, which makes a lot of sense. On the other side it says California Regiment. They called themselves that throughout the war, even though they had had their designation changed. They got their baptism of fire at Ball's Bluff. Questions? Sir? Holmes was in Company A of the 20th Massachusetts. He was wounded. He, as near as we can figure, would have been standing about where the cemetery now is. He was hit by a spent ball in the chest, knocked the wind out of him. He went back, caught his breath, came back out, and was hit again in the chest. Yep, right there.
Quite a sound. Yeah, right. There you go.
Gets hit again with a very lucky, actually, because he's hit. Apparently he was standing this way, and the bullet comes and hit him in the breast, basically, and passed through and lodged just under the skin on the right side of his chest. Okay, didn't hit anything important. It just hit meat. Mm-hmm. Didn't hit his heart or lungs or anything. One of the guys squeezed the bullet out, just kind of popped it out, He was unconscious, so he didn't feel that, but he gave it to him later, and so he had this bullet as a souvenir. He recovers. He goes back in. As bad as that sounds, and given the state of medical knowledge in 1861, it could have been really horrible. The surgeon of the 20th Mass, assistant surgeon, a guy named Nathan Hayward, wrote up the reports of all the casualties of the 20th Mass. Lieutenant O.W. Holmes, flesh wound of chest. That's what it was called. Literally, it was a flesh wound. All it hit was flesh. So he goes back to Boston and recovers and becomes Oliver Wendell Holmes. Sir?
Command assessment of Shank Evans' performance?
Evans did a really good job. I really talk more about the Federals here because it's kind of their story, their defeat story. But Evans did a good job. Evans did not know, of course, what was going to happen. He knew that there were Federals across at Ball's Bluff. He knew that there were Federals across, and I didn't really get into this. One of the things that Stone had done early in the day when he sent the raiding party at Ball's Bluff was he's crossed a small detachment, about 30 guys, from the 3rd New York Cavalry at Edwards Ferry. And he had them ride out the Edwards Ferry Road and make some noise. That, by the way, is the third prong of this big three-pronged envelopment. It's 30 guys from the 3rd New York Cavalry. Their orders are to make some noise, get the Confederates looking at you so the raiding party at Ball's Bluff can do its thing and get back safely, and then you guys will fall back too. Well, they're out there doing that. They actually do exchange shots with the Confederates a little bit and then fall back. But while that's going on, Stone has been told by the messenger that there's actually fighting going on. So he says, all right, I'll tell you what, Stone's thinking. Stone's a sharp guy. He does today what we would call preposition resources. He says, I'm not quite sure what's going to happen here, but I got a feeling with McCall there in Drainesville he might be coming in. McClellan told me yesterday he was in Drainsville. Watch for him. He might be coming. I got a little action going on here on the right. Looks pretty okay. Nothing big going on there. I'm going to cross over troops here at Edwards Ferry. And he does. He crosses over a couple of thousand troops at Edwards Ferry. And he doesn't do anything with them. He has them stack arms right on the floodplain, which is today the ninth fairway of the River Creek Golf Course. So if you play golf at River Creek, when you get to the ninth hole, stop for a minute and take off your hat. That's where all the Union troops were. He leaves them there thinking, as soon as I get word from McClellan, because I think I'm going to get an order to advance. He's just kind of thinking ahead. Or if I see that McCall is coming, then I'll have my guys in position. We'll already be across the river. I can move them forward. We can link up with McCall. We can do something. Baker will be over here. We got an opportunity here to do something that comes out of this weird little reconnaissance patrol and everything that could be a wonderful sort of denouement to this little silly thing that happened, this little mistake that was made. He was waiting, and he waits. Shanks Evans is watching all this. Oh, my God, here they come. There's all these Union troops. Wait a minute, they're just stacking arms on the floodplain. They're not doing anything. Fighting is going on at Ball's Bluff. So gradually, he shifts his little 2,800 guys now. He doesn't have a lot of men. From Edwards Ferry, where it looks like the Federals might be coming, to Ball's Bluff, a little at a time. So he weakens his position there without letting Stone know it, strengthens his position at Ball's Bluff, and gradually feeds more and more troops into Ball's Bluff, getting them there more efficiently than the Federals are, because they're coming over in dribs and drabs in these little boats, squeezing through this bottleneck. Numbers are dead even. 1,700 Yanks at Ball's Bluff, 1,700 Confederates at Ball's Bluff. Both sides, the officers on both sides, write action after action reports that claim they were heavily outnumbered by the other side, but the numbers are dead even. But the Confederates are in better position. They show up at the right times. They've got somebody actually in command. Evans does a very good job. All the talk about Evans being a drunk, there's no question that the man drank a lot. Okay, the boy liked his liquor. But if he was drunk at Ball's Bluff, which he may have been. Some people said he was. Epa Hunton said he was drunk. A couple of other people, a captain named Otha Singleton from the 18th Mississippi, and another captain named Albert Gallatin Brown, who happened to be the senator from Mississippi with Jefferson Davis when Mississippi seceded and the two of them left the Senate. Brown takes a captaincy, a senator with a little humility, decides, I'm not going to be a colonel or a general. I don't know anything about the military. I'm going to be a captain. He also says, no, he wasn't. He writes later and he defends Evans, says, no, he was drinking. But whether Evans was drinking or not, it did not have any effect on his decision making. He did a good job.
As we discussed at dinner, there's a joke that we've been working at the round table here about the Trump golf course and the River of Blood. But you touched on something you might want to enlighten some of the folks about that maybe.
John Minor Botts. Virginia Unionist, former state legislator in Virginia, very much a solid pro-Union Virginian, totally opposed secession, was trying to convince the members of the Virginia Secession Convention before the war not to secede. And one of the things he was saying was, guys, you got to think about this now, because if Virginia goes, the war is going to be fought in Virginia. Right. We're right here. It's going to be in our backyards. It's going to be in our houses. Don't do this. And if this happens, the Potomac will be drenched in blood. Maybe that's where Mr. Trump got his River of Blood thing. I don't know. But you did have, of course, in Ball's Bluff, you had all these guys who were killed in the river. So you had 160 or so bodies that were floating down the river, washing up, interestingly, on the Virginia side. There's no record that I've seen of any of them washing up on the Maryland side. Well, it's below, all the way down. There was one found at Mount Vernon, washed up on George Washington's lawn. There were 161 was the official number of missing, and you can bet those were 161 bodies in the river. Mm. All went over Great Falls. They were in the water for days and days and days. This would not have been a pleasant thing to find on your lawn.
Right.
Sir?
Of course, afterwards, the Joint Committee on the Conduct of War, for various reasons, said it's all Stone's fault.
Yeah.
Arrested and held for 6 months.
Right.
How much do you think this affected McClellan's mind? He was cautious to begin with, and when he leaves Washington to fight at Sharpsburg, he writes, I was putting my head on the ball. How much do you think everything McClellan did in 62, in the back of his mind, if I am advanced,
yeah,
something happens.
It certainly reinforced McClellan's natural caution. I don't think there's any doubt about that. We know for a fact that shortly after the battle, McClellan stood up for Stone because the wolves started howling right away for Stone. And sort of public opinion, newspapers, political opinion broke down into Baker and Stone camps. Baker's dead. Baker's a United States senator. He's the best friend of the president. He's a gloriously died on the field of battle, you know, and all this kind of stuff. So you bump it up the food chain, which is the division commander, and that's Stone. So a lot of people went after Stone. But McClellan came right after the battle, did his own investigation, and he publicly stated that the fault was not that of General Stone, but of the commander on the field. He was right. But that's not what Baker's friends wanted to hear. So they continued to go after Stone. Now, if it had just been the battle, if it had just been about a lost battle, eventually that would probably have blown over. And McClellan did stick up for him for a while. But about a month after the battle, he had a couple of instances involving runaway slaves. On the day of the battle, there were two guys who were owned by John Smart, who owned Smart's Mill. They were brought back across the river against their will by the Union troops. And they went to Stone and said, "Can we go home? Our wives and families there. We want to go back." Stone said, "Okay." And he got in touch with the guys on the other side. And the Rebs didn't want them to come back. They wouldn't let them do it. It took like 6 weeks of maneuvering, but they finally let them go back. So these two guys, at their own request, went back to Virginia. Stone got savaged for returning slaves to their rebel masters. About the same time, two slaves from a Maryland plantation showed up in the camp of the 20th Massachusetts. United States law at the time included the fugitive slave law. Maryland state law included a state fugitive slave law. And Lincoln administration policy was that we have to placate the slave owners of Maryland because we don't want Maryland to secede. Therefore, if you're a slave from Virginia and you get across the river, you're free. But if you're a slave from Maryland, you got to be returned to your owner. And Stone, following federal law, state law, and administration policy, ordered the return of these two slaves. That got reported, got to the governor of Massachusetts, the abolitionist, to Senator Charles Sumner, and Sumner went after Stone again. Oh, he's great. He savaged him in a speech on the floor of the Senate. He's great at losing battles. He can't beat the Rebs, but he's great at returning helpless slaves to their rebel masters. Okay? You want to?
One more question.
Okay.
When was Fort Evans, Fort Johnson, Fort constructed?
It was over time, starting in the summer of 61. They started all three of them in the summer of 61. At least two of them, probably Fort Beauregard and Fort Johnston, were not completed by March of 62 when the Confederates left, but they were all being built a little bit at a time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.